This is the Planning Commission work session for Thursday, October 6, 2016, 5:30 p.m. Okay, Rod.
Okay. I'm Rod Swanson. I work in the Clark County Public Works Department in the Clean Water Division. About a year ago, we came through with a stormwater manual that was a little over 1,000 pages long. And now we're coming back with some what I'm calling errata changes and other minor revisions to it that we've either discovered or had people tell us about. So originally we were hoping just to take it through consent with the board as it was essentially errata to the manual, but then we discovered that the level of some of the changes we're making rise above errata were actually content changes, and so we've got a fairly large document with about 80 minor changes that I would call errata, formatting and typos, that type of thing, and then another 15 or 20 that actually change content in some minor way. Since we're not doing a code change, we didn't have to notify the Department of Commerce under the GMA, and but we will have to have a hearing to update the manual. So we'll have a Planning Commission hearing on the 20th, and then we have a board hearing scheduled, the Board of County Councilors hearing scheduled on the 22nd, the week of Thanksgiving. In the package that we have, there's a brief staff report, and I think I found a couple typos in it and gave another copy to Sonia. I don't know if she passed that out or not. And then the next item is essentially a list of all of the changes that we're making. And then the third piece in there is pages where we've made changes to the manual that are other than a footer change. We had to change the footer on every page because we changed the date to September 2016 for the errata version. And instead of revising the manual, we've essentially inserted the errata in as little text boxes where we had to, or strike out, underline, partly because it's such an incredible effort to edit a document like this because it's a very complicated Word document. Then the third item is the SEPA DNS, the back of the package. So in the staff report, I listed some of the items that go beyond just being errata. And if you'd like, I can just walk through those and tell you what they are. If you have questions, I can answer your questions. I can just walk through the sure. items. Okay. So we did a huge stakeholder involvement on the manual. We had a technical advisory committee. We did some talks with the DEEB, and we also had a stakeholder committee that had members of the public. And so with this large stakeholder list, we were able to reach out, and we said, oh, we're going to be making some revisions to the manual. If you have anything, you know, that you think, you know, is an error or an omission that we have, please send it to us. We received a couple of comments, not too much. Staff kept popping up with things that we were including up until just this last week. Last week we added one more thing. The items are listed here in the table that comes after this. The staff report has them individually, so you can see what the actual language would be if you want to look to those. Item 8 was a language that was in our code. When we went from code and two manuals to just the one county manual, we took a lot of information that was both in our code and auxiliary manual from 2009. And as we were doing that, sometimes things got dropped. And one of the things that was dropped was language in our stormwater code that prohibited concentrating runoff onto an adjacent property. So we put that in the manual actually in two places. A new thing that staff came up with, we'd have to inspect roughly 1,100 private stormwater facilities each year. And sometimes it's challenging to get into those because the owners have locks on them. So from now on, with this change in the manual, there'll be dual locks on them, so that our staff can enter those facilities once we have easements on them. Another item that was in our code that was dropped was some FEMA-related requirements for conveyance systems on 100-year floodplain. And I think what happened there, and I'm speculating to a certain degree, is that that language is more appropriate in our floodplain regulations, and I thought it was going into there maybe, but we put it back into our manual to make sure that we had whatever level of regulatory standards in Clark County that would help maintain the insurance rating level that we have. In other words, it keeps the insurance rates down.
Can I go back to the lock for
sure.
just 1 second? I just have a question.
Yeah.
If there's going to be two locks on it, and the reason that you have two locks is so the county personnel could go in there and inspect it, how do they get the private lock open?
I don't know how mechanically they will put the dual locks on. I think
separate links.
Oh, go ahead.
Different places.
You just do it like that, then it comes off and like,
oh, it's something that's connected to
each
the private lock.
Makes a link.
Or you could do them like chain links, or maybe some special lock devices. I don't know.
Okay.
But it just makes it so we have a
few.
It's really a pretty common thing to see on gates. You know, they'll have like a chain.
I'm envisioning a padlock and a county lock. That's got yeah. it. Okay, thank you.
Oh, thanks for asking. Well, by the way, thanks for coming down tonight for such a, I think, relatively minor item, but I'm glad to see you here. Oh, let's see.
Where's the thing we're talking about regarding FEMA and floodplains?
It's item 11.
Item 11, okay. That was the FEMA floodplain one?
Which version?
Yeah,
you have a different version of that
table. I have
table
one that's been on my desk for a week.
Yeah, we added some items since that was produced. And this is the version you need here.
Okay, thank you.
I know, it's been kind of crazy. We've been just sticking these things in at the last minute. Now I don't have it.
Yeah, too bad.
Yeah. Oh, and then item 20 relates to how the mandatory low-impact development requirements are applied for projects that drain to large water bodies like Lake River. So if you have a pipe that goes all the way from your project into Lake River, it doesn't require flow control. In other words, a detention pond or something like that. The LID requirements are all essentially categorized as flow control or flow reduction BMPs. And so there was a heading on a table that referred to projects that trigger all the minimum requirements or minimum requirements 1 through 9, but it also applies to projects that only trigger minimum requirements 1 through 5, which would be a smaller project under 5,000 square feet. And actually, Ecology caught that one. I think the writers of the manual didn't consider that if you don't trigger flow control, you don't have to worry about these removals of the mandate for LID. And it just was kind of an oversight on their part.
What's 13?
13?
I don't know.
It's long.
Oh, we added some vegetation requirements to keep them away from structures, where they could impact structure.
Okay.
26, we changed an or to an and so that it was a little stricter about the information that's required if somebody is going to put a infiltration facility on a property. 36, in the wetland requirements of the ecology permit have fairly complex thresholds in them, and somehow in our process of developing the thresholds for minimum requirement 8, we left one out that requires a stormwater analysis for wetlands that have endangered species, even if they're very low quality wetlands. And as far as I understand it, this particular threshold will almost never be crossed because we know where all the endangered species are, and by knowing where they are, they're already higher quality wetlands, so it's kind of an odd requirement, but it's just fine. We have an appendix, item 37, is in the appendix I of book one, and we tried to make a small project manual for projects that only trigger minimum requirements 1 through 5. That would be anything under 5,000 square feet. And there was a section in there that was overly broad in describing BMPs that need some kind of groundwater depth information. So we clarified that. Item 39 is another repeat of the not concentrating flow onto adjacent properties included in the small project manual of Appendix I on book one. Item 40, we corrected a flow chart so that matched. This is also in the small project appendix. We corrected an applicability flow chart so it actually matched exactly what was in the main book of the manual. Item 48 is we added in a BMP in book two, I believe it is, there's a table of sequentially preferred LID BMPs, and if you get to the bottom of that table in a subdivision or urban development project, you put a thing called a perforated stub out to the street. And we added language to make it abundantly clear that you couldn't just take roof runoff and run it into an underground infiltration system or detention system, because a lot of debris can come off roofs. Oh, and the Department of Ecology, after we all submitted, all the Phase 1 permittees submitted their manuals in June 2014 for ecology review, they went out and made a lot of revisions to their manual that we had to be equivalent to after we submitted our manuals to ecology for review. So that kind of created a pickle that we worked through with ecology. And there were a couple changes that didn't get brought into our manual in the final version. One was there was additional language about the design of bioretention facilities and the soil mix that goes into those. And so we replaced the language from the 2012 ecology manual with the language from the 2014 ecology manual. Item 52, we had a fairly strict prohibition against runoff from landscaped areas into permeable pavement, and we took the language from the ecology manual and replaced what we had there. And then 68 and 70 are planting standards for minimizing obstructions in facilities. And then along that same line, book four of the manual is our maintenance standards, and it has some additional updated vegetation maintenance standards that relate to protecting the function of detention facilities.
So how do you pre-treat your runoff before you put it into the perforated pipe?
The perforated stub out is in lieu of like a rain garden or a drywall for the roof runoff on site. So if you have clay soils, you can't do a drywall, you can't do a rain garden. And if a site's too small, you can't disperse the stormwater onto the lawn. So then you just put a pipe to the street. The pipe, the perforated stub out is actually a perforated pipe buried in a trench with river rock. So you do get some on-site retention. But the concern that we had was that, you know, debris from the roof, you know how things can get like that, would be directly routed into, say, base material under a paved road or a permeable pavement, and it could clog it up, and we would have a non-functioning stormwater facility. So at least it has to go to some kind of pre-treatment facility or a basic treatment facility.
Like a catch basin.
It probably, yeah, it would need to, I don't know how the individuals would, but you could design it so it goes into a bioretention facility, for instance, where it's open. Well, you could just route it back in the crawl space, I don't know. But so yeah, that was something that caused some concern for people just in general. Generally, what historically people have done with roof runoff is they try to infiltrate it on site, because that's what we more or less require people to do. And if they can't do that, they run a pipe out to the curb, a little hole in the curb. So then it runs down the street, and if it goes in the catch basin and goes into the treatment facility, then it's included in sizing the treatment facility.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking like in my area, the clay is so prevalent that you really can't.
You can't do much, yeah.
Does this, what you're talking about right now, does this relate to the chatter I'm hearing from the home builders? They're all up in arms because they've got to go remove 12 inches of the soil from all their yards, haul it off, and replace it with topsoil?
That would be...
Or is that something else?
That's an on-site requirement that doesn't have anything to do with a perforated stub up, but it's a standard requirement of the ecology permit. It's actually 8 inches of compost amended soil, or they could take the original topsoil off the site, stockpile it, and spread it out. But it's one of the more challenging new things that people need to do to finish a building project.
But it's not new. It's been in the manual since 2009, right? Or been in our ordinance.
It's been in the code, and it's been in building permits.
Yeah, it's from
and
MR.
It's not been enforced, or because they're talking about it like it's something they have to do now that they haven't historically done.
I'm not sure the degree to which it has been enforced. I think there was some confusion about it because people looked at it as an LID requirement that was optional at the time, but it isn't really. And it was in the code.
It was since 2009, and we're not changing that provision with any of these proposed.
It's from MR5, and no, it wasn't changed.
But speaking of roofs and runoff from roofs, I heard about a situation of a house that's being built somewhere off of 179. It's on an acre and a half, and the runoff from this person is having to remake 5 feet wide, 5 feet deep, put rock in it for the drain off of the roof, several of them. Is that really what has to be done?
We don't
would
have
it be the soil? Would it be certain soil types that this would be in, or is this a requirement for everyone? Because it's like
how people implement the requirements case by case is hard to speak to, but the requirements themselves are inflexible from the Department of Ecology, and they're in our stormwater permit.
Okay.
And one of the things we say is we don't go beyond the requirements of the Department of Ecology. And so that's been a real challenging thing because the LID BMPs require soil analysis to be designed properly because they're infiltration BMPs on site. And to be quite honest, the requirements of our stormwater manual for infiltration of roof runoff are stricter than they are for septic systems as far as the site characterization goes. And the kind of things we're hearing back is, you know, oh, I paid an engineer, you know, $2,000 to tell me I need splash blocks, that kind of thing. And we're working on that process now, and it's new for all the engineers that are doing this work. Another thing is, traditionally in Clark County, we've exempted small projects, minimum requirements 1 through 5, under 5,000 square feet, from requiring an engineer stamp for their stormwater drainage design. And most other municipalities of the size of Clark County generally require an engineer to design these things. There are counties where, Pierce County in particular, I had a conversation with a few years ago, where it wasn't necessarily the county that was driving it, it was a licensing board for engineers that was saying, you can't have landscape architects design these, you can't have septic system guys design these, it has to be an engineer. So I guess if you designed your own, you're probably okay, but if you pay someone to do it, probably it's best to get an engineer. That's just my opinion. But I'm not an engineer either.
Tell me about filtration vaults.
I play a geologist. What? Pardon me?
Tell me about filtration vaults.
What about them?
There's lots of them.
State is now allowing them versus a retention pond or detention pond.
So a vault, like a filter vault, is a treatment BMP. It's designed to remove, say, 80% of the total suspended solids in the stormwater. by running it through filter cartridges. It doesn't do anything to reduce the rate at which the water flows. It's not designed to do that. We've been, Clark County has allowed filter vaults since about the year 2000. There are individuals, probably, there's thousands of individual filters and vaults in Clark County. It's a fairly popular treatment method. And so, but once it goes through the vault, that would be minimum requirement six, which is treatment, treating the stormwater pollutants as much as the state requires. And then in order to prevent that additional runoff from developing a pasture or forest or whatever, that increased runoff then has to meet the requirements of minimum requirement seven, which is flow control. And the way the state of Washington does that is there is a computer model that tells what the duration of erosive flows is from a forested site based on the soil and slope and land cover up, not land cover of the site. Then the engineer puts in what his developed site will look like as a land cover, amount of impervious area, landscape, whatever. And then that model tells him how big of a pond he has to build in order to make the duration of flows that erode the stream, which is like once it happens, say, once every year or so in a forested condition, how big of a pond he has to build in order to meet that standard.
Well, what I'm concerned about is the filtration vaults that have to be serviced about once a year and have the filters changed, which is fairly expensive.
It is.
So you allow a neighborhood that doesn't have a CCNR use, the builder uses these, and I don't believe the county has in place any mechanism to go out and monitor these. And to me, it's a problem waiting to happen. I don't think we've used them very much yet in the county, but
there are lots of them. There are hundreds. Yeah. I don't know how many there are, but they're very common. There'll be just one or two filters in some kind of a vault or a manhole. But under a stormwater permit, we're required to have a program to inspect all regulated facilities, which are ones the county doesn't own, every year. And the performance measure is that we inspect 80% of them. So we usually shoot for 100% and get there. So then the trick is, you know, working with the owner of the facility to get the maintenance done. And it's extremely difficult when there's no HOA collecting money for it. Yeah.
That would be tough.
Well, and that's when they contact my office, and I. There are a variety of responses that I give depending upon the situation. But you know, if it's a place where 10 people own home sites and the runoff flows into this thing, and they don't have an HOA, or they have one, but they. Golly, we just didn't collect our dues or whatever. Each of those homeowners gets a rather insistent letter.
And a bill for it? Or do they, would they know the,
Well, if it's either you fix it or we will begin enforcement proceedings and then
and we'll
you'll
collect,
pay for fixing it.
Well, it'd have to be that way.
Yeah.
We have one individual who mostly what he does is work with facility owners to get them into compliance.
And he's really persuasive and really nice, so that it helps a lot.
Yes.
So how many private facilities do we find are out of compliance for maintenance? And do we ever take them over?
Almost very rarely does the county take over a private facility.
You mean like take ownership of it?
Take ownership of it.
Is that what you mean? Or do you mean, okay. Yeah, I'm not aware of doing that while I've been.
It has happened. It's not something that we've been directed to do. I'm guessing that there may be in the last 10 years, maybe five facilities that the county has taken over, but I don't really have a number for you. It's not really
Wonder, because it isn't hard to drive around, and it's not hard to tell the difference between a privately maintained facility and a publicly maintained facility often. And you have to wonder about the functionality for what we're trying to accomplish.
You know, that's one of those kind of eternal, at least theoretical issues. So do we require that the private landowners do it? That way they retain as much control over their property as possible and so forth and so on. Or is that something that the county, which is all the taxpayers, do for the benefit of those private landowners? And as well as whatever social benefits accrue because of it. And it's an interesting set of policy questions. Mostly, if it's in the right-of-way, for example, it's a county facility. If it's a private subdivision, it's a private facility, but not exclusively.
No, it's the developer has the choice when he does a subdivision, a residential subdivision, of putting the facility on a tract and dedicating it to the county with a maintenance bond for 2 years, or putting it on a tract and giving it to the HOA and then maintaining it himself for 2 years. And, you know, it's up to that individual developer to decide under county code.
Yeah, and it's never the first 2 years that I see. They look great for the first 2 years.
Yeah. Sometimes they don't. It's something we're really working on now as far as the regulated facilities is improving the enforcement on them. It's a priority we're working on, actually.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're starting that by some of the changes to the proceeding to get the plat or the site plan approved.
Right, they have to form the HOA before the plat is approved instead of saying they'll do it someday. Thanks for reminding me of that one.
Yeah, because one of the issues is when the developer, you know, has gone bust in the recession and, you know, might be in Tahiti or might be in Idaho or might be wherever, and never turned over the common assets to the HOA or never formed the HOA, you know, then what do you do? Well, that's kind of an issue. So we are requiring, before we will record a plat, the developer to do those things.
Any more questions? Great, thank you.
All right, thanks. I guess we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah, the 20th. I'll bring the big guys to that one.
Okay. Well, is that the only thing on our agenda today? I guess we are adjourned.
You know that person you were talking about, 179?
Yeah.
My